Hey, Chutzpod listeners. I want to tell you quickly about another podcast that I think you might really like. It's called Love Letters. The show is hosted by Boston Globe advice columnist Meredith Goldstein, and it tells real people stories about dating, relationships, and falling in love. The theme of the new Love Letters season is thanks for the help. You'll hear beautiful stories about the many different ways that people get help or assistance in their romantic lives, from friends, relatives, from therapists, and even from their exes. Love Letters from the Boston Globe and PRX. New episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Joshua.
Hello, Rabbi Shira. We're back.
We're back. Chutzpod, ancient texts for modern times. We have a great episode today.
Yes, one might say a very special episode of Blossom.
We have to get her on the podcast at some point.
Oh, yes, indeed.
But for today, we have not one, but two guests.
Two esteemed guests, one of whom I'm quite intimate with, and the other is my wife. But seriously, folks, my dear wife, Melissa Merwin Molina, will be joining us, and Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, will also be joining us.
Yeah, there are two different kinds of conversations, but I actually think there's a way that they go well together. One is more about the head, and one is more about the heart and the soul. And, you know, whatever, those things together, that's the fullness of Judaism.
Reese's. It's a spiritual Reese's. Peanut butter and chocolate.
I remember. I was a child of the 80s, too.
Hey.
Oh, you put your chocolate in my peanut butter.
Peanut butter in my chocolate.
What?
I was a child of the 70s.
I want to ask you a question, which sounds a little dirty, but it's really not. It's about today's Torah portion. What are you wearing?
I'm sorry, but Rabbi, in Hollywood, we say, who are you wearing?
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. Who are you wearing?
I'm wearing Cotton Bureau's finest t-shirt. I'm wearing a t-shirt and sweatpants, as I have been for much of the pandemic.
Oh, it's the pandemic uniform. We're going to talk about that a little bit later with Melissa as well. And so when you wear that kind of clothing, how does it make you feel?
Like I haven't left the house in weeks and months. Comfortable and yet also a little pathetic, if I'm honest. Thank God for live Zoom events, which have given me the impetus to occasionally put on a button-down shirt, something with a collar, and occasionally during the pandemic. And I have had intermittent dance parties with my wife at home, for which we have dressed ourselves in a festive fashion.
Really?
Yes.
So you and your wife get dressed up in party clothes and have a dance party, just the two of you?
Yes. I have a $13 disco ball. We turn that on. Cheap party favors from Party City. Not a sponsor, but a great store. We decorate, blow up some balloons, create a playlist, dress up, and dance. And there's usually champagne involved. It's very festive. It's a lot of fun.
That's the most romantic thing I think I've heard in a long time. So this week's Torah portion is called Titzave. And it's about a few different things. But the bulk of the portion is about the clothes that the high priest would wear. And you know how, like, over the last few weeks, we've been talking about the specificity in the descriptions of the tabernacle and how it was built and the materials that were used and how big they were and the specificity in terms of the high priest and what he wore. He was always a he, and what he wore when he was engaging in rituals is also incredibly specific. And that's what I want to talk about today. Your hand is up. Yes?
And the first high priest was Aaron, Moses's older brother.
That's right. Moses's older brother. That's right. And then it was like a dynasty, right? It was his relatives who became the priests after him.
It was our house of Windsor.
That's right.
The sons of Aaron.
So the high priest had this very specific clothing that he wore, which leads me to a question for you. Do you have special clothing that you wear at special times? So obviously you have your tallis, your prayer shawl, or your kippah, your yarmulke that you'll wear. You like how I translate the word kippah as yarmulke? Your head covering that you wear when you're praying or at other points. But I don't know, are you a sports guy? Do you have a jersey that you wear whenever your team is playing? Do you have like special boxers that you put on when you have a new part?
really what resonates most with me is that I'm an actor. So I put on costumes for a living. And for sure, what I wear informs my energy and how I feel. And there are some actors who will tell you they start with that kind of stuff. Daniel Day-Lewis has to go out and cobble his own shoes or whatever. But at that first costume fitting or wardrobe meeting that you have as an actor, you start really getting the whole character down, because what a person wears works both ways. It's reflective of what's inside, I think. It speaks to how the person wants to present themselves to the world. So there's a lot of power in clothes.
Yeah, actually, speaking about your role as an actor, I think this is a perfect time to throw to our conversation with Melissa.
And now, what a treat. I get to introduce my wife, Melissa Merwin. Melly worked in Hollywood for over a decade. She worked in costume departments as a costumer, a costume supervisor. She was assistant to Oscar winner Colleen Atwood on a couple different movies. And more recently, she owned a lovely flower and bookstore in the Pacific Palisades called Isarose. She is a bubbly delight. Please welcome to the show my wife, Melissa.
Welcome, Melissa. I said to Josh, this is the most excited I've been since we started this podcast, is getting to meet you, Josh's better half, as it were.
And it's the most nervous I've been, and we've already interviewed a congressperson.
Wow. Thank you both for having me.
I kind of now want to delve into why Josh is nervous. So here's my question for you. I don't know if you had a chance to read over this week's Torah portion, but you know, the biblical author goes into a tremendous amount of detail about the clothing that the high priest was wearing when he would do his job, a lot of which, by the way, was in private. I mean, it was just the priest and God, right? And so it's interesting that for the small amounts that were public and then for the parts that were private as well, it was really important what he wore. And I'm wondering if that's resonant to you, given your career. When you're thinking about how to dress someone in a show that you're doing, what goes into the thought process?
Well, first, I feel like it's important to say that I don't do that anymore.
Now she only dresses me in a non-professional fashion.
It leads me directly into that even normal clothes are very performative, and it's such a crucial way of communicating who you are, what your politics are. Everyday clothes are costumes. But yes, when I used to work, it was endlessly fascinating working with the actors, because so many times I fit them in shoes and they would say, okay, I know who I am now, because they walked differently. And that's a private thing. Most times, especially in TV, you never even saw the shoes, but that told them who they were. I remember some actress, we decided she should always wear wedgies.
Wait, wedgies must mean something different to you than to me.
Jewish summer camp, that means your underwear pulled up in the back.
Yeah, exactly. You know those slip-on shoes, but they have a heel?
Oh, the wedges. Yeah. Okay.
Click, click, click. And also your body moves in a really specific way.
I think this idea that all clothing is performative, when you say it, it's one of these things, it's like, of course, but you don't think that way. One is, do you think that there's something that has been lost or gained? Earlier in the podcast, Josh was saying how for the 2 years of the pandemic, he's basically been wearing sort of like his schleppy clothes. I forget what word he used. And so number one, I'm wondering if you think that there was something lost or gained by the way we've changed what we've worn during the pandemic.
Yeah, well, I think it's really different to answer that question as a woman than as a man. But that's a whole other podcast, because I think the fact that women are allowed to wear comfortable clothes and comfortable shoes is kind of huge. And looking back, that's a sign of real rebellion, you know. But for men, I don't know. I started reading about men's tailoring and suits, and really that was a sign of power and entitlement. So maybe turning away from that is a good thing. Maybe it's more inclusive and breaks down social barriers. I personally feel better if I have a decent outfit on, but that could just be putting on actual pants with a waistband, which is very rare these days.
By the way, when I really want to dress up, I put on pants, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Zoom does not necessarily call for pants.
Exactly. No, I have sweatpants on right now.
That's such an interesting distinction. So the sort of gender distinction that female identifying people are expected to wear a a certain type of clothing, often that's more restrictive, and that in pandemic land, a lot of that has been let go of. And it's so how lovely that that sort of corresponds with our expanding understanding of gender and how gender works in this world. I hope that we don't go back to the way it was, or if we do, they start making women's pants with pockets. I'll take either one.
I would like that just so that I don't have to hold Melissa's chapstick anymore. I get a lot of, will you hold this and this and this? And I say, honey, I have lines I'm trying to maintain as well.
But going back to your question, I think about the priests mainly being in private, it's sometimes you work from the inside out and sometimes you work from the outside in. So you're cueing other people, but I think often you're cueing yourself that this is a sacred moment or something special is going to happen.
Do you think this is true across cultures, or do you think it's more true in cultures like the American one, in which there is more, for instance, fast fashion? There are more clothes that you can get for very little money, or we're more capitalist in nature. Is this something like innate, or is it something learned, this performative nature of wearing clothing?
I think it's innate, personally. And I think color is very literally woven into all of that, too. And the scarcity of being able to get like purple, that was a really hard, expensive dye to get. So the colors were linked to how much money you had and scarcity.
What Melissa is referring to is that the Bible was very specific, not just about the structures and the clothing, but about what color they should be as well. And that there's this dye that comes from a certain snail.
A mollusk, right? Is a snail and a mollusk the same thing? It is wild.
I don't know. All I know is they're not kosher. Yeah, it's wild. There also aren't many of them in the desert, but that's what certain pieces of clothing and certain parts of the tabernacle had to be dyed in. I know that when my dad was sick, he went to a healer, and it was a color healer who sort of found my father's color, which he said was violet. To be honest, it became a little bit of a joke in our family, but also my father started wearing more clothes in violet because he felt like it reflected his aura.
Interesting. That was a big deal. Do you remember that? Everyone, all of my mom's friends got their colors done. But I don't, when was that? 20 years ago or something? That was hot, hot, hot.
Yeah, I guess it was about 20 years ago. That's right.
Melly and I have been contemplating color just recently as we did a little repainting, and we discussed and looked at and pored over different colors we might paint our room. And Melly had done some research about what might be the most common. We wound up with a fairly hot pink.
Shall I tell you what that's from?
Please do, Melly, because I know you did your research before you painted.
I know, we. I like all the we's. It's called Baker Miller Pink from a Prison, or Drunk Tank Pink, because they learned it reduces aggressive behavior.
This is like we're moving a little bit closer to couples counseling here.
To be fair, I've always liked pink. Always, always, always.
What I like about this conversation is one of the ideas that I hope Josh and I can really bring home in this podcast. We think of Jewish culture and Judaism as being so much about the head, with the books, with the learning, all the time the learning. But the truth is that you don't even really have to go very deep when you scratch the surface that you see actual Judaism spiritual tradition is about all of the senses being awakened, and one of them being the sense of sight. And do you feel like a sort of a spirituality of color or a spirituality of clothing? Like, are there ways that certain colors make you feel sort of closer to God as you understand God, or certain pieces of clothing as well?
Actually, when my son was bar mitzvahed, our very sweet cantor, I studied with him and I read a little bit from the Torah, and Josh's father gave me a tallis, which was a beautiful heavy silk. It was incredible, but I really felt his acceptance because I'm a convert. Yeah, this is going to move me. Clothing cues you, and sometimes who gives it to you?
Right, the history of it.
Yeah, I think we all do that. We have our grandmother's necklace.
That's a beautiful story. You know, I think one of the meanings of the tallis of the prayer shawl is to feel like you're wrapped in God's presence. So you were feeling like you were wrapped in God's presence, but also sort of the extended Melina Jewish people, that, you know, you're part of the Jewish people in this way. And you had been Jewish for quite a while by then, but this was just, there was something different about that moment.
It was new to me, and sort of recently I studied with Rabbi Cheryl Lewert, who really touched me, and she told our whole class, she kind of gave us permission, you ladies can all wear a tallis. And I had felt, you know, shy, or I didn't deserve it. And that was really meaningful. And a lot of us made them together. And then we would go to shul and have wear them. And that was very special.
Wow. I mean, that touches on a few different things. The idea of making it yourself is quite beautiful. The idea of having a community of people with which to do this ritual, right? You know, you walk into synagogue and you feel like you're part of the club because you have your tallis too, as opposed to feeling othered. And then on top of it, this idea of doing it with a group of women who have been denied for so much of our history, and in some places still are denied, the ability to physically wrap ourselves in God's presence in that way. I mean, it's quite moving.
Yeah. And it's portable, you know, wherever you are.
Like the Mishkan.
Boom.
Boom. Personal tabernacle. Order yours now.
On that note, thank you, Melissa, so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melzi. I love you. I say this to all our guests. I really, really love you.
Love you too.
Melissa, thank you so much, first and foremost, for putting up with Josh, but second of all, for coming on the podcast today. You know, it's interesting. This time of year, for me, all signs point to the Jewish holiday of Purim.
We're getting excited.
We're getting very excited in about 5 weeks or so. And so one of the things that happens on Purim is you're supposed to dress up. And there are a lot of reasons that we are instructed to dress up, but one of them is to be able to show your shadow side. It's not a costume in that it totally hides who you are, but that it reveals something about you. And so I think about that for an actor, what you have to do is it's not your personal shadow side, but you have to, like, as you get into the costume, you start to become a different person or a different part of who you already are.
Yes. I mean, how much do adults love Halloween? I mean, a lot of people letting out their inner sexy cat on Halloween.
Sexy Harry Potter. And actually, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the high priest. And in a second, we're going to get to some of what they wore. But I do encourage you people to go online and type in high priests, and we'll put on some of their pictures of a high priest costume. You have to imagine these guys, you know, day to day, they're in the desert. And so they're not showering that much. You know, their clothes are probably not, there's no Brooks Brothers down the street. I mean, who knows? Because there were dolphin skins down the street, but there's probably no Brooks Brothers down the street. And so the idea of having something really special to put on when you're coming into contact with God, and even more so representing the people, it makes a tremendous amount of sense.
Yes.
So the part that I actually want to talk about is the breastplate. The Hebrew phrase for it is the choshen mishpat. And so do you want to describe what the breastplate looked like, Joshua?
There are 12 precious stones. I believe these correlate to the tribes.
Yep.
There is specificity about what stones. This one's an emerald, a sapphire, a diamond, all these different things. The breastplate is bound by rings. I know there are bells somewhere.
Yes. Can we digress to the bells for a second?
Please let's.
They are not connected to the breastplate, but I love this. That at the sort of bottom of the priest's, I don't know what to call it, except the dress that he wore, there were these little pomegranate bells that would ring whenever he walked around so that people could hear him coming. The most well-known reason given for it is in case his encounter with God is so intense that he collapses and dies. And so the Israelites will not be able to hear him walking around. They will not be able to hear his pomegranates shaking. And they'll know that something's gone terribly wrong. And they'll pull him out of the inner sanctum. I don't know if that ever actually happened, Baruch Hashem, thank God. But I just love the idea that, again, we get this with Judaism all the time. It's like it's meant to be a full sensory experience, right? It's not just about the visual of seeing the priest. It's about the smell of the incense he's carrying and the sound of the bells.
Yes, and I will say here that I discussed the bells briefly with my dear friend, Rabbi Gamliel Shmalo, who goes back to grade school with me, Westchester Day School. He said I should not miss that the Talmud says about the bells that they are there to remind us not to speak Lashon Hara, not to gossip and speak slanderously. And the sound of the bells reminds us to be heedful about the sounds that we make.
I never heard that teaching. That's beautiful.
Isn't that? I like that a lot.
Yeah, and it actually connects to, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about today, which is if we're talking about the breastplate, the Choshen Mishpat, the plate of judgment, you know, as you said, it has these 12 precious stones, and each one represents one of the 12 tribes. And, you know, there is this idea that the high priest, the uniform that he wore was mostly about grandeur, but it was actually grandeur as connected to actual human beings, grandeur as connected to each of the 12 tribes. And so that's why I love this teaching about the bells as being connected to reminding us not to gossip, reminding us not to do Lashon Hara, the evil tongue, as you said, because I feel like so much of Judaism, again, we're going back to like the Netzach and the Hod, right, is about sort of the peak moments, like when the high priest would put on his uniform and go into have a conversation with God, and also the Netzach, the day-to-day of not doing, not gossiping, which for me is a very, I need a lot of reminders.
As do I. Sometimes I'll get invited to an event and I'll say, I'll be there with bells on.
Is that where it comes from?
Maybe this is where it comes from. And maybe what I'm really doing when I say that is I'll be there and I won't talk ill of anyone else at this party. And it's a good reminder, I should be there with bells on. Watch what I say when I'm gathering with other people.
According to Google, it doesn't actually come from the Bible, but you know.
Google's not going to acknowledge the Jews.
I know, anti-Semites.
Check Jugal. On Jugal, they tell you that be there with bells on came from us.
Joshua Molina, always trying to bring everything back to the Jews.
Give it a shot.
Okay, we have the breastplate. It has the 12 stones, but inside is something called the Urim and the Tumim. Do you know what that is, Joshua?
Yes, I have a stake in this discussion as Yale University's motto.
Oh, for sake, again with Yale.
Sorry, you set me up. You set me up. Yale's motto is Urim V'Tumim, and it's in Hebrew. The Yale seal has those two words in Hebrew, Urim V'Tumim, which has been, I think, slightly mistranslated into Latin, which is also under the shield of the Yale seal. It says Lux et Veritas, which means light and truth, which isn't quite a direct translation of Urim V'Tumim. To me, I think, is Urim, lights. V'Tumim is like perfections, right?
Yeah, the word tam, those of you who have ever been to a Passover Seder, it's often translated as simple, like the simple child, but you're right, it really means unblemished. Wait, that is fascinating. And so do you know what the Urim and the Tumim were about?
I think they were specific objects, right? They were objects on the Choshen.
Yeah. So what they were an ancient magic eight ball.
Wait a second. Wait a minute. Let me find my notes. Wait a second. Do you see me holding this up?
All right, listeners.
Magic.
Listeners, I see Joshua.
Magic eight ball. I love that you and I have the same reference points. I can't believe I wrote magic eight ball. I feel like I should win a prize now.
The magic eight ball is still a thing, though. So it's not just us middle-aged people.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I guess that's true.
But anyway, there is this sort of, it's like the opposite of this moment that we live in of uncertainty. The Urim and the Tumim, apparently, you could ask it a question, and depending on the way it's shown, it would give you an answer. I wish, but we don't have that anymore.
And you think the Jews in the desert are constantly going up to the high priest and like saying, does Cindy really like me? And then shaking the breastplate and looking for, you know, signs point to yes. Who was allowed to ask a question of the ancient, of the proto magic eight ball? How was it used?
Unfortunately, for people like you and me, like peon Israelites, it was really only probably, as far as we know, army generals, the most senior court people, leaders. So they had to ask like serious questions. It can't just be, does Jenny like me or not? Also, there probably weren't many Jennies among the ancient Israelites, but okay.
Does Miriam like me? Which Miriam? Can you narrow it down, please?
Why do you think it was important for the breastplate to have the 12 stones as representative of the 12 tribes of Israel?
We talked about a little bit of this caste system developing. So maybe it was important to let everyone know they were represented. Like, yes, certain people are priests or everything, but you've all got some representation, even in the Holy of Holies.
That's beautiful. Think about how we're actually just learning today, all over again, some of us, how important representation is. Even in ancient times, there was some understanding that everyone wanted to see themselves somehow, even though the high priest was separate and different than they were, right? As we talked about last week, it wasn't even like rabbis today who are rabbis, we're just like you. but they actually were different. But still, people want to see themselves reflected. And I think also the high priest needed to be reminded of why they were doing this work in the first place.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Not just for us to feel good that we're represented there, but for the high priest to remember that he's there not just on his own behalf, but he has a huge responsibility and burden in representing us to God.
Not only did he have the breastplate with the 12 stones, but he also had the names of all of the tribes were sort of engraved on his shoulder pads somehow. There's a midrash, and the midrash says something like, with what zechut, like with what merit, did the high priest enter the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum of the tabernacle? The rabbi who answers, named Rabbi Yitzchak, he says it was the merit of the tribes. I think there's like a two-way street there, which is kind of beautiful, actually. And I think, you know, when you see leaders go bad, often it's because they forget to decenter themselves and to center the people that they're representing.
I like this idea also of this external thing, clothing, reminding us of the internal, who the person is. I remember one explanation for, we have something called tzitzit, which are these fringed garments that are similar to the talit that we've talked about, the prayer shawl, right? Jewish men, and I guess it's some women nowadays, I don't know, but wear under their clothes and have these fringes. And I remember hearing one explanation was that if you were specifically about to commit the sin of adultery or something that involved taking your clothes off, you get to that last layer and these tzitzit remind you who you are and how you should be acting. I like this idea of having this external thing that reminds us who we are internally.
There is a story in the Talmud about a rabbi who was about to sleep with a
congregant,
a sex worker, or someone who was not his wife, sure, somehow, and his tzitzit literally slap him in the face. Like, yeah, they, you know, and you could see how they do. They're like, you know, they slapped him in the face until he realized that what he was doing was wrong.
I like it.
And so I do think, you know, there is this way that the clothes that we wear, and we have lost some of this in COVID, perhaps, right? The clothes that we wear are meant to be representative of who we want to be in the world. And, you know, that's why even when we're talking about ethics of the clothes that you wear, right? Knowing who made them, where they were made, how much the people who made them were paid, what the working conditions were like, all of those things should matter to us, because clothing is not just some trash. It's an outward reflection of the world we want to build.
I like the idea of inspiring ourselves. It's not just for other people. Something you wear is also you're speaking to yourself and asking yourself to live up to how you're presenting yourself.
Oof. Right. Right. It's like when you wear a kippah or a yarmulke and you go out on the street, you are treated differently and you act differently.
I wore a kippah all day because I went to Orthodox yeshiva. And then I came home and I took my kippah off, probably on the bus before I, you know, went into my house, because I didn't observe in an Orthodox fashion. There were times I can remember keeping my yarmulke on, like when I went to then walk the dog after school, hoping that I'd get a negative reaction. This is something sick and twisted about this, because I really didn't.
So twisted.
Well, I didn't really experience anti-Semitism, I feel, as a person in my life, and perhaps in part because I'm surrounded by Jews at school. It's almost like I wanted that. Yeah, you have a problem with it? Come at me. Bring it. Never happened. I guess, unfortunately, I lived in a nice neighborhood that was very tolerant of Jews and had plenty of Jews. But I can even remember, it's like I was wearing something, I was wearing a costume as wanting to provoke my self-righteous anger. Maybe I'll take this up with my therapist and not with you.
They're actually a very deep comment. I want to spend time letting it marinate, because what are the ways that Jews can show up and be seen as Jews in the way that we want to be seen in the world, especially those of us who don't wear yarmulkes on the street, who don't wear the sort of distinctive Jewish clothing? We certainly know that sometimes we show up when others find us for anti-Semitism, and that might be some of what you were thinking about on these runs. But in other times, what are the things we can do? Do we overemphasize how we speak? Do we take our Jewish stars and wear them outwards rather than inwards? I think it's all something to really contemplate.
I am not immediately identifiable as a Jew as I walk down the street. Many of my people are. I read a story today about a guy who snowplowed two Orthodox Jews on purpose, and it was filmed, and he's been fired. But like somebody who saw two people wearing a costume that identified them as Jews to him, observant Jews, no less, and he attacked them for it. Part of me wants to, in solidarity, mark myself in a recognizable way as a Jew. I wear a chai, but it's, you know, it's under my shirt.
I know.
I do have some things that, you know, you would assume if I wore them that I'm Jewish, but I don't live it every moment. And I wish I were more easily identifiable.
I actually think this is a good time to transition into the conversation with Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, who's going to talk to us about anti-Semitism and the unfortunate ways that some of Josh's sort of imaginings, childhood imaginings, are coming true.
Jonathan, we're very happy to have you. You are, of course, welcome here anytime, but there is a timely reason to have you on today. People have been reaching out to me through Twitter and through emails saying they want to hear the rabbi's thoughts about what happened recently, the brouhaha about Whoopi Goldberg's statements on The View, in which she said that the Holocaust is not actually about race. It was more about man's inhumanity to man.
It's not about race. It's not about race.
What is it about?
Because it's about man's inhumanity to man.
And she framed it as being a conflict between two white groups. To her credit, she did ultimately apologize, and you appeared with her on The View to sort of explore the issue. We wanted to discuss with you, and I want to hear also what the rabbi has to say about the issues surrounding the scandal, the controversy, the question. The professional ramifications of what she had to say is that she has been suspended from her job hosting, co-hosting The View for 2 weeks. Do you think that was appropriate?
Well, look, I really don't know what ABC's internal processes are. I don't know how the decision was made. But what I do know is that I believe in this concept of teshuvah, which Jewish people are familiar with, this notion, this value of repentance. And I believe that if someone, there certainly are serial offenders, people who are unapologetic in their intolerance and don't demonstrate any degree of contrition. But when you have someone who I think authentically wants to do better, acknowledges their error, accepts responsibility, and asks for forgiveness, I think we need to forgive. I think we're almost obligated, Torah obligates us to do that. So for me, her apology was one that I accepted. Let's acknowledge that not only did she apologize online, she then was, I think, part of the process of giving me the platform to join her on The View and talk about why this mattered and engage in a kind of dialogue. Now, in all fairness, I think that there may be better ways that she and her public could spend the next 14 days rather than her being home on paid leave. There probably are better ways to use that to engage in a learning process that's inclusive and encompasses, again, not just her alone, but others. I accepted her apology wholeheartedly, and I'll reiterate today my degree of discomfort with what she said and then my degree of, you know, satisfaction with how she came around.
I had a similar response. Once I saw her on with you, I thought there was a net gain, which is that there was an educational aspect and an outreach aspect to exploring. One element of the question is not very nuanced. Of course, the Nazis saw the Holocaust as about race and attempting to commit genocide against what they considered an inferior race. But the actual discussion about race and where Judaism falls in that discussion is more nuanced. I was not so clear myself. I learned through the process. And I think maybe rather than removing her, seeking more opportunities to educate and to discuss would have been a better way to go. What do you think, Rabbi?
I love that framing in terms of net gain. I think all three of us wish that this hadn't happened. I'm sure Whoopi Goldberg wished that this hadn't happened. But given that it happened, is there a way to get to a net gain? As Jonathan said so eloquently, she apologized. She spoke with Jonathan. It was a very long interview for The View. And the idea that she was rewarded, as it were, with a suspension just feels like a swing and a miss. I mean, we Jews, we are not a people who are about human perfection. We are a people who are about human striving. And tshuva, as Jonathan said, is not about becoming some sort of ideal deity, but instead about just doing a tiny bit better every single day. And it seemed to me that's what she was trying to do. And I can't imagine that the suspension helped her in her. And that's some of what Jonathan was saying also in terms of like, how could we have used these 2 weeks in a different sort of way? It leads me to another question for you, Jonathan. One of the things that I've found in my rabbinate, and I'm interested in your experience sort of out on the street, as it were, is that one of the problems with talking about anti-Semitism is that it's really hard to define it. talking about how anti-Semitism functions is extremely complicated, especially because in so many places that Jews have lived, we have been permitted to rise to a certain level of wealth and power. And so it doesn't compute when we think about other forms of hatred, and that even Jews, really, they know the events, the Crusades, they know the Holocaust, the expulsion from Spain, but they actually don't know how anti-Semitism works systemically. Has that been your experience? And if so, I don't know, what do we do about it?
Very good, very thoughtful question. To respond to a bit of a circuitous way, relate the question to the earlier question. I think what Whoopi Goldberg was doing is trying to take the hexagonal, the 20-sided die of anti-Semitism and fit it into the round hole. And guess what? It doesn't fit. I mean, race is a social construct that changes in time and place and varies by culture and, you know, epoch, if you will. And in our current moment, race is thought about as communities of color, predominantly, if you will, Black versus white, which is a function of the legacy of African enslavement of the country and other forces. And it's a real issue. There's no question. The data tells us systemic racism is real. The data shows us that these biases are deeply embedded in many of our systems. While we work to do better, they're still there. But so many Americans with the Today Share and in our time see these issues of hatred and think about anti-Black racism with which so many of us are familiar in one way, shape, or form. And so it can be hard when you think about anti-Semitism. Well, how does it fit? As I've had people say to me, well, I don't understand. She said the Holocaust was white on white crime. Isn't that true? Aren't you white? I had someone else say, I'm not a race. I'm Jewish and it's a religion. So don't tell me that we're a race. That's what Hitler said. I don't believe that. This is my faith. I'm not a race. And then other times, you know, we know that anti-Semitism has taken different forms. Sometimes it's racial, if you will, like during the era of eugenics in the Nazi Germany. Sometimes it was faith-based. You know, we know there are plenty of Jews who would never set foot in a shul who still consider themselves Jewish, right? And they say, well, I'm a cultural Jew, not ethnic, not religious. I'm cultural. It's hard to find a cultural Lutheran, right? I challenge you to go find me the cultural Unitarian, you know?
Oh, we're going to hear from them, Jonathan, and I'm going to forward the email directly to you.
The cultural Catholics will probably hear from.
There may be some of those. So, I mean, I think all in all, Shira, you're right. It can be very difficult to explain anti-Semitism because it doesn't neatly fit in any one box. It's more like water that can take the shape of any vessel in which you pour it. And you know, there have been those who talk about anti-Semitism as the oldest conspiracy theory, right? Rather than a hatred against a people, it's this kind of misinformed way of seeing the way the world works. What it really is in many ways, I think, is this oldest human impulse of otherizing, right? And you know, it's not a new phenomenon in these instances where you had a failure to understand or make sense of a situation, right? You couldn't make sense of the weather. You couldn't make sense of health. You couldn't make sense of global forces. People, when they don't find answers in the science, as it were, they look to scapegoats. And the Jews, as this people permanently in exile, right? Or at least for the last 2,000 years, the state of Israel notwithstanding, the Jews were always the available other. You know, that was an easy target for which to blame on things and to explain the unexplainable. Why did that child die? Why is the weather changing? Why is everyone getting the Black Plague? Blah, 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 blah. How do we justify our monarchy? How do we justify our church? How do we, and so on and so forth. The Jews were always an easy target. And the biases that, you know, became the different facets or dimensions of anti-Semitism, tropes about money, tropes about power, tropes about influence, tropes about deicide, tropes about blood libel, and so on and so forth. These things like seeped into the kind of the collective bloodstream of Western society and simply became part of the way that people see the world. And so there are so many of these stereotypes that are now part of, again, like Shylock is just a cultural kind of shorthand we know for the evil kind of like moneylender, but we know that's really anti-Semitism. I could give you many examples like that, but I think it has become simply, again, part of the collective bloodstream of Western society, and it's very difficult to tease out.
You said so many important things there, but the Torah-related thought that I had while you were talking, talking about Jew as the eternal other. And whenever there's something we don't understand, we sort of try to otherize it. It makes me think about next week's Torah portion, which is, of course, the golden calf, which we'll study on the podcast next week. But this idea that was perhaps the first recorded creation of an other in a moment of dysregulation. Sometimes you have to allow the dysregulation to happen, and to move to the type of idol worship or othering is not the right way to go. It sort of takes us out of the godly realm. I think that's really interesting.
Whether it's the Jewish people or now it is the Jewish state, we seem to play this role of the eternal other. And, you know, it's deeply problematic.
Jonathan, I read your book and the title of the book just brings up my blood pressure, you know, 100 points, however we measure blood pressure. I want to say the title of this new book is It Could Happen Here, Why America is Tipping from Hate to the Unthinkable and How We Can Stop It. It's a really scary title. It feels to me like you are crying fire in a crowded theater. And a lot of the people think that there's no fire. But what you're saying is, no, there actually is a fire in this theater. Do you really believe that this is true, that we are very close to a point of no return? What do you do at night?
I use the title, obviously, if not obvious, it's an allusion to Sinclair Lewis's book, right, which he wrote in the 1930s at a time when the Nazis were coming to power in Germany, the Nazi Party, and people in America didn't take it very seriously, didn't understand what it portended. And that's why Sinclair Lewis, who was an acclaimed novelist in his age, wrote the book. And it's imagining what if it were to happen in the U.S. And it was very gripping in that moment. I don't think we can take for granted and just assume that everything's going to work out. Because the analogy isn't that I'm yelling fire in a crowded theater. The analogy is I'm sitting in the theater and I smell smoke. And maybe because I'm Jewish and it's encoded in my DNA, if you will, I have a heightened sense of smell or a sharper antenna, and I smell the smoke before anybody else does. And I am saying, there is a fire. I really believe that many of us, having lived all of our lives in this country, which I believe in American exceptionalism, this has been the most vibrant, most dynamic democracy in the history of the world. It has given so much to humanity and so much to the Jewish people. There are real issues here, no doubt. And there were even bigger issues here 100 years ago when ADL was founded. But it has been a blessing for the Jewish people on every level. We can live openly as Jews. We can live freely as Jews. We can worship where we want. We can live where we want. And yet, the idea that this is somehow preordained by natural law is a fiction. It's a myth. Like you're driving your car, Shira. You drive it all the time, you know, and you assume, oh, it's just going to keep going straight. But if we take our hands off the wheel, the car will actually go off the road. I worry that our democracy is going off the road. And I got news for you. Maybe it's an imperfect analogy, but in the car of American democracy, we're the ones, if not in the driver's seat, we're in the passenger seat. We're not wearing a seatbelt. So when we have an impact, the Jews will fly out the windshield. And I just believe this because again and again and again and again and again and again and again in our history over the last, I don't know, 2,000 years, this is always what happens. And so I think the hate that we've seen explode over the last 5+ years, 6 years, I think of it as a corrosive force that like is eating away at the pillars of our democracy and at the values that bind it together. So I do worry a great deal. It is why I wrote the book.
If I can bring the conversation full circle at the end here, I think the normalization of hatred towards Jews is one of the reasons we have to be careful not to denormalize conversation around the topic. And so that's why I don't think we need to tell Whoopi Goldberg and others, you can't discuss it unless you're discussing it exactly this way. We have to normalize these uncomfortable conversations about it and learn together and keep that out in the open rather than saying a conversation about it can't even be part of the normal course of events.
I totally agree. I mean, let's think a different way that The View could have done it. Imagine if they had 10 days of education about the Holocaust and hate. Imagine if they published an education guide for their viewers on the, I guess they have a website or maybe an Instagram channel. Imagine if every day they brought a guest to do like a 5-minute piece, you know, and anti-Semitism, as Deborah Lipstadt, you know, the nominee for Special Envoy and the esteemed Holocaust scholar has said, anti-Semitism starts with the Jews. It never ends with the Jews. imagine if you talk about anti-Semitism and use that as a jumping off point, talk about other forms of intolerance and the linkages and the relationships.
Well said, and thank you so much for joining us. That was great.
Hey, this is a treat for me. Like, I'm on the chutzpah, man. Like, I have made it. I'm a chutz pioneer because I'm one of the early guests. I'm looking for some chutz swag. Like, that's what we got to get to, you know?
Oh, it's going to happen. It will happen. This was a great, great interview. Thank you so much for your time.
Super fun to do. Keep up the good work, guys. Take care.
Thank you, Jonathan. That was a great conversation. It was great to have you. Listeners, we're now going to take a quick break.
One of the roles that Torah plays right now is in giving people a mirror to what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, and maybe even a window to where they want to go. I'm Alana Steinhain, Rosh Beit Midrash and Senior Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. I'm excited to share that I am the host of Texting, a new podcast where ancient wisdom meets contemporary relevance from Hartman's award-winning digital team. On each show, Hartman scholars Christine Hayes, Yona Hain, or Leah Robotnitsky will join me to delve into a Torah text that offers insight and inspiration about the issues that matter to you and to our community.
I got the feeling from the various explanations that the rabbis gave that God also feels broken.
You can listen to Texting at shalomhartman.org/texting or wherever you get your podcasts. I look forward to learning with you.
And now it's time for the part of the show where we invite an honored guest to review the Hebrew and Yiddish terms that the rabbi and I used during the episode. Rabbi, would you like to introduce today's guest?
Oh, for sure. I mean, Josh and I thought it was only fair that since Melissa was going to be on today, that the lovely Russell should be on as well. And so without further ado, I introduce Russell. I had nothing to do with the following segment.
Lashon hara, Hebrew, literally the evil tongue. Lashon hara is slander, derogatory speech, gossip, and a big no-no in Judaism. Tam, Hebrew for whole, unblemished, innocent, pure, as in Tom Hanks. Urim v'tumim. These are mysterious objects that were part of the high priest's breastplate and helped him make important decisions. Urim v'tumim is also Yale University's motto. Josh went there. So did I, many, many years later. Midrash. This one should sound familiar. We've gone over this before. Midrash is rabbinic commentary on Hebrew scripture. Choshen Mishpat, Hebrew for breastplate of judgment. And coincidentally, this was my nickname in high school. Talis or Talit, a Jewish prayer shawl. Baruch Hashem, Hebrew, meaning literally, blessed is the Lord. It can be used in place of thank God, as in Chutzpod is currently the number one Jewish-themed podcast in the Cayman Islands. Baruch Hashem. If you want to get tipsy, take a shot every time my wife says this phrase during the show. Rebetzer, a rabbi's husband. Rebetzer? I hardly know her.
Thanks, Russell. I love you.
I do too. Love you, Russell. We have all sorts of people and organizations to thank now. We could not make the show without our executive producer, Tim Shovers, who is Atlanta proud. We love PRX, the fabulous company that distributes our podcast. You can find out more about them at prx.org. We love Hadag Nachash, fabulous band that allows us to use Lazuz as our theme song. And what else? We like each other. We like our listeners. Oh yeah, social media. You can follow Rabbi Shira on Twitter, at Rabbi Shira. You can follow me. I'm at Josh Molina. There's at Chutzpod. We also have Instagram accounts. We have a Facebook page. We have a website, www.chutzpod.com. Visit our website, leave a comment, subscribe to the podcast. And now, just a heads up, as I like to give everyone, you thought it was all over, but it isn't, because our podcast will wrap up, as we traditionally do, with a lovely guided meditation from the rabbi. So stick around for that.
I want to do a reverse meditation today, by which I mean learning against this week's Torah portion rather than with it. I've been sitting a lot with the idea of the Urim and the Tumim as these oracles that could give us answers to all of our questions, and wondering if it was indeed a gift to have them in the world. We live in so much uncertainty, perhaps especially in this moment, politically with COVID, but I think more likely the truth is that life is filled with uncertainty and most of it is out of our control. And we don't have an Urim and we don't have a Tumim. We have our gut, we have our community, and we have our spiritual connection. So as you take deep breaths in and out, in and out, I ask you to consider the ways that uncertainty is a blessing in your life, that the ability to stand in front of two paths in a woods and not know which way to go is an opportunity and not just a challenge, that there are third ways that can open when only we pause, acknowledge not only what we do know, but also what we don't, hold it all together, and then just try something new.
And this is Russell Shaw wishing you a Shabbat Shalom. From PRX.